Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. This is episode 28. This week I talk with Paul Gilmartin, comedian and host of the Mental Illness Happy Hour podcast. We also talk about his character, Ohio Congressman Richard Martin, and his love for underrated guitarists and guitar lore. It's a great episode. Thank you so much for checking out the Andy Dare Show. All right, thank you so much for tuning in to the 28th episode of the Andy Dare Show. I'm your host, Andy Dare, and today I'm over the moon to be joined via Skype by Paul Gilmartin. How you doing, Paul?
Wow, I'm flattered. How's that in a word?
That sounds great to me. Paul Gilmartin is the host of the Mental Illness Happy Hour podcast, and been checking that out, having a great time listening to that. I'm full of issues myself, so always like to hear other people's issues. Are you having a fun time doing that one?
I really am. There's a lot of times when I do an episode and people will email me and go, "What did I just do? I'm not sure I want that aired." And I always email them back and say, "No, that's a sign that it was a good episode," because people are, you know, one of the scariest things for people to do is to reveal things that they're vulnerable about. And yet that I find that that is the key to, for me, a lot of the happy moments in life is being able to let go of my ego and just kind of trust the universe and just process. And I don't know, it's something about that show feeds that part. And a lot of, I get emails every day from people that say, thank you for the show. It makes me feel less fucked up, less alone, less broken. And I get a lot of emails from people that said it was the final nudge that I needed to go get help, get professional help. So
really, that's awesome. Yeah. That's all you can really ask out of a show. And I found out that, people are more alike than different. I mean, I can even relate to the Kulap Vilisek episode, and she couldn't be any more different than me, you know, a guy in Chicago. But yes, I took away some stuff that I could relate to myself with. So,
well, that's great, Andy. I appreciate that.
And, if they want to find the podcast, they can go to www.mentalpod.com and follow you at Gilmartini on Twitter. Am I correct?
Yeah, there's actually two other Twitter feeds that I have, too. I have one for the podcast itself, and that's Mental Pod. And then the other Twitter feed is for my Republican character, and that's Ohio Congressman.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, I didn't want to spill the beans about your character. I didn't know if you wanted that shrouded in mystery, but then I realized that it's all over the website. You got to put two and two together. But to be perfectly honest, I caught about three of your appearances on the Adam Carolla Show, believing you were a real guy and really interested in the whole thing. And finally, my friends had to come to me and spoil it all. And then I put two and two together, remember seeing your face on TBS and stuff like that, and I put it all together. But man, you got some range. If you can do all, you can do that character and then do your normal stand-up, it's awesome, man.
Oh, well, thank you, Andy. That's really nice of you to say. I appreciate that. And trust me, there's a lot of people that listen to Adam Carolla that are not a fans of that character. So I had to stop reading the message boards. But Adam likes the character and thinks it's funny. And that's all that matters as far as he's concerned.
I totally agree with you there. I'm a big Carolla fan, been for 15 years, so love seeing you on there. I'd like to take it back for my listeners. I heard you grew up in Chicago. How about whereabouts in Chicagoland, if you will? Whereabouts?
Yeah, well, I was born in South Holland, and then my family moved to Homewood, and that's where I spent most of my childhood was in Homewood. Then I went to school at Indiana University in the mid-'80s, and then graduated from there and moved back home for a couple of years, then moved downtown to, like, Lincoln and Belmont, was there for about 7 years, and then moved to L.A.
Sure, so right in Lincoln Park, huh?
Yeah. I guess that what we called Lake Central, something.
Lakeview
Central, I think. Yeah. It's funny. It had not been gentrified when I moved there. In fact, I remember when my roommate and I, Pete Moore at the time, I was funny, too, because he was working at the Hard Rock Cafe. His fellow waiters, if I'm not mistaken, were Stephen Colbert and Stephen Carell.
Really? Huh.
Yeah. We all kind of knew each other from Second City. And Pete and I moved into this place. It was $550 a month. It was on Lincoln Avenue at 3052 Lincoln Avenue, and $550 a month for this. And it had just been redone. So, you know, new wood floors, freshly painted, but it was in this it was a sketchy area of town, and there was like a bum pissing in the stairs. You know, the first day we went to check it out, at the back stairs, but still the stairs.
Yeah, now it's just Cubs fans pissing in your stairwell, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Now it's lawyers pissing drunk on a Sunday.
But for $500, geez, that's awesome.
Yeah, but I loved it instantly. You know, there's something that I really miss about Chicago is the ability to walk out your front door and go to get five different ethnic cuisines to eat without having to even get in your car. That's what I remember about living there, and being able to go walk to what's the bar that has the five bowling lanes?
I know what you're talking about.
It's that going to that bar. We used to walk to that bar, and that was just, you know, you'd see the little guy's legs as he set the pins, and they served good beer. And there was just so many things that there's so many things that I miss about Chicago. Winter not being one of them.
Definitely not. And yeah, I had a band for a long time, and trying to get your friends to come out to a little club in the middle of like a blizzard warning, it's just impossible. I mean, it's next to impossible to try to get them to do that. So yeah, so I just went with the podcast route, and I've been talking music with a bunch of, you know, people from the entertainment world, having a blast doing it my first year. So.
Oh, cool. Well, I actually, a band that I played in post-college, kind of the summers of my college, up at Grand Beach, Michigan, those guys went on to form Mr. Blotto. I don't know if you've ever heard of the local band Mr. Blotto.
I have, actually. That's awesome.
Okay. Yeah, great guys. And then the other guitarist from our band went on to form. Oh shit, I'm blanking it, and I'm going to blank on the name now because it's been so many years. But they actually got quite a bit of notoriety. Freddie.
I'll have to have my listeners take a listen or take a look on Twitter or something for me, but. Yeah, that was the era of like Material Issue was big in Linkin Park,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And before that guy killed himself, they were pretty promising. They had a couple strong albums, and
Smashing Pumpkins were. Although I never was aware of them at the time, because I was certainly not a music scene hipster by any means.
No, sure. Did you ever make your way over to the Metro? That's my favorite place in Chicago.
I did. I would go see They Might Be Giants whenever they would come to town, and they were one of my favorite bands. They're, you know, just literally nothing else like them. No template for them. I suppose the B-52s would be the closest thing, but still not even
something you could compare. Yeah, that's crazy.
No, just the fact that they both had humor and sounded different would be about the only thing that you could compare between the two. But yeah, my wife and I were huge fans of. And still are of They Might Be Giants.
Yeah, in a time when alternative music was dead serious and you just were trying to show your pain to the world, They Might Be Giants did something ironic and funny and different. So
exactly. It was every music was so serious, and it was so refreshing having, you know, that was like the era. As much as I love U2, that movie about them, what was it? What was the name of the movie that they did in like 88?
Rattle and Hum.
Yes, Rattle and Hum. And it was so, they took themselves so serious. They were like the anti-Beatles. and then They Might Be Giants came along, and it was like, yes, this is what music needs. It needs to not take itself so seriously.
They made fun of themselves, and that's
good. Yeah, they made fun of themselves, but they're great musicians, great melodies. I mean, you got to love any band that writes a song about Edith Head, you know? That's just...
Intellectuals can dig them on another level too, which a lot of bands you can't. So,
yeah.
So you were there, and you were doing Second City after college, or?
Yes, I went through their training program. I was never a paid performer there, but I went through their school, and it was a real experience. It was really great. There was Bonnie Hunt was in the class ahead of me. Chris Farley was in the class behind me, and it was just a really cool experience. And that, but I didn't get accepted into the company when I auditioned, and I was crushed. So I did what I really wanted to do, but had been afraid to do, which was to start doing stand-up. I was just afraid to go on stage alone, so I had no choice.
So when was the first stand-up gig for Paul Gilmartin?
In Maryville, Indiana, in March of 87. I had done it once or twice in college, but that was the first time in earnest, like, okay, I'm jumping in.
Was it really a nerve-wracking experience, or was it something I could do this?
Well, both. Both. That's the only thing that kept me going, was I knew that I had something creative inside me that I just knew there was creative energy inside me that I wanted let out. Plus, I had changed my major from biochemistry pre-med. I was like practically a straight A student at Indiana, getting ready to take the MCATs and apply to med school. And I had taken a stand-up course, an acting course to help me get more comfortable about the upcoming student stand-up competition, because my roommate who had talked me into signing up for it, and I fell in love with acting. It was like, you know what? I don't want to be a doctor. I want to do something creative. Little did I know I can't act, but but I could do stand-up.
How did the parents feel about that? Did they give you some little bit
They were supportive, because they'd always told me, do something that you love and the money will follow, because you'll do it well. If you love it, chances are you'll do it well. And then the thing they qualified it with was, but don't go into advertising.
As long as it's not advertising. Yeah. If you love it, it'll come through. No, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So 87 was really the golden age of stand-up for most people. Were you aware of that at the time, or was it just like, let's just give it a try? Or did you know, hey, this could be a perfect time for me to get my head in here?
The boom was just starting. I mean, it was literally as the spark was kind of exploding. From 87 to 90, or I would say 86 to 90, Chicago went from having I think Zany's and the Comedy Cottage and maybe one other club to having 16 full-time clubs. I mean, to wrap your head around that, 16 full-time clubs. I don't think the four-state area around Chicago now has 16 full-time clubs.
I don't think so, yeah. It's like CD stores now. They're all closing, yeah. So.
Yeah, yeah. And it was good and bad. It was good in that you got a lot of stage time, and bad in that everybody was doing stand-up. So the level of comedy that you had to sit and listen to was awful.
A lot of jokes about pet food and,
name it. And I'm sure I was, to some people, I was one of those comedians, thinking that the differences between dogs and cats were so riveting and interesting. But the friendships that I formed back then are so important to me to this day. It's how I met my wife. Jimmy Pardo came to be one of my best friends. Jimmy Dore came to be a really great friend. Just a lot of great people.
That is so awesome. So how long till you decided to make the trip out west?
In 94, my wife and I felt like, okay, we're ready to make the move, because you don't want to make the move to Los Angeles when you're a feature act, because you don't get your airfare paid for when you're a feature act.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be at the edge of the country trying to book all your stuff back in the Midwest when you're a feature act, because feature act paid maybe $600 a week back then. So so who's going to pay for airfare out of their own pocket? Airfare is $300. So all of a sudden you're going to be making $300 a week. Well, you're not going to be able to pay rent on that.
Especially not in LA.
Not in LA. And sadly, the money for stand up that really hasn't gone up. If anything, it's gone down. I actually remember some of the better clubs would pay you $800 to feature. And you won't even find a club that pays you $800 to feature now.
Huh.
Even adjusted for inflation. It's
still not really nice money, huh? Yeah.
No, it's just I don't know what. I suppose there's too many comedians, or the economy's too bad. I'm not really sure.
And now it's a way to promote your podcast a little bit, right?
What, going out and doing stand up?
Well, a lot of guys now, they do have a little podcast on the side or something to promote, So.
Yeah, I would think that it's probably the other way around, where the podcast helps the draw people in for the club dates. I know for Mark Maron, that's been a really big boost. You know, he wasn't drawing anybody 2.5 years ago, and now he's selling clubs out for the entire week.
That's so cool. It's such a new industry, and you're right on the vanguard of it. And it really is affecting it. Yeah,
it's so exciting. I was interviewing Carolla for my show, and we were just marveling at the fact that his parents live 2 miles from the warehouse where he records his podcast. They'd never been there, and they don't even realize that he is a pioneer in a completely new industry that is changing the way we entertain and communicate. No idea.
Yeah,
he's going to be included in books years from now. He and a handful of other people are going to be included in books about podcasting pioneers, and they have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having a radio show in the 40s, or it's like having a cable television show in the early 80s. You know, it's just the same thing. And people aren't really giving it the respect just yet, but give it 1 year, and I'm sure it'll just be as important as HBO or Showtime or whatever, you know, whatever's popular. So,
yeah, there's really something beautiful about the empowerment of somebody not being able to step in and tell you what to do. There's something so liberating about that. And Graham Elwood, who does a great podcast called Comedy Film Nerds, had when I was thinking about doing a podcast, he had told me, he said, do it. He said, do it. It's just it's so empowering. And I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I was like from the school of punk rock, so like do it yourself anything is something that I love, and I couldn't think of anything more like punk rock for Adam to just, you know, get shit canned from the radio show on Friday and start his own show on Monday out of his garage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so easy, and it's just, you know, it's fun, it's easy, and there's no middlemen, and I'm loving it. So
yeah, you're right. It is very punk rock.
So you went to L.A. in 94. How about any favorite concerts you saw about like when you arrived to the West Coast?
Oh, well, that's a great question, because I got in with a group of guys. I started playing street hockey with a group of guys that I just saw skating down the street one day. And one of them happened to be the head of backstage security for the Universal Amphitheater, which is now the Gibson Theater. And so if you played on his hockey team, you got free tickets to whatever concert you wanted. And
oh, man.
This was when K-Rock was doing their acoustic Christmas shows there every, and I tried not to abuse the privilege, but I got to see K-Rock acoustic Christmases, and he would give you tickets to the front row or in the pit. So, you know, I got to see Blink 182 before anybody knew who they were. They were like a guest on K-Rock's acoustic Christmas show, and one of their singles had just come out on K-Rock. Nobody knew who they were, and they were making fun of the fact that nobody knew who they were. And I remember there was another say what you will about Blink 182, whether or not they're, you know, they're punk or not, but that night that I saw them, they were more punk than Rancid. Rancid was on the stage, and the lead singer for Rancid would do this thing where he was like staggering around like he was drunk, but he didn't seem drunk. It seemed like he was putting on an act, and he would not, after every lyric, he would knock the mic stand over, and some fucking roadie who's getting paid $10 an hour would have to run out and set the mic stand back up. And I was like, dude, you're sticking it to the underpaid.
And yeah, that's not very punk rock to make. Yeah, the roadie set up your mic after every time you knock it. I don't agree with that.
Yeah, it pissed me off. And then Blink 182 came out. They made fun about the fact that nobody knew who they were, that nobody gave a shit, that they were going to try to get laid after the show, I think. And then during the songs, they were trying to unplug each other's instruments. And I was like, dude, that is fucking punk rock.
Yeah, they were pretty punk rock. I mean, all the songs about them not getting laid, you know, like, you know, getting detention and stuff, even though when they were in their mid-20s, I think. But
that fun, that amount of fun, that here is the biggest industry break you can get, and these guys are fucking with each other, trying to unplug each other's guitars while they're playing. I just I was a fan right from the get-go from that. I got to see oh God, what is why am I blanking on her name? Plays the piano.
Oh, Tori Amos?
No, the other super serious one. She was a prodigy at like 18. Why am I blanking on her name?
Alicia Keys.
No, white girl. skinny. I can't believe I'm fucking blanking on her name. She dated the director of There Will Be Blood for a while. God damn it.
Now I know. Vanessa Carlton? No?
No. No. She had the album that had like 19 names to it. Super, super long name.
Alanis Morissette?
No, and I know right now your listeners are screaming the name at it because it's so obvious and it's right on the tip of my tongue.
Fiona Apple.
Fiona Apple. I had pit passes, and I was up so close watching Fiona Apple play a song that she was – it was like a really sad, serious song. And you could tell that she was really excited to be there, but she starts playing this really sad, serious song, and she's hunched down over the piano, and I was up so close, I could see up underneath her, and she was smiling while she was singing this really sad song. Just these amazing moments, this privilege of being able to see all these great artists early in their career and up close, no doubt. Got to see them right when they broke. Saw Beck. Stone Temple Pilots. I got to see Scott Weiland stoned out of his mind and horrible and sober and fucking blow the lid off the place. Smashing Pumpkins, the Allman Brothers, Jeff Beck a couple of times. I mean, the list goes on and on. And then my friend moved away and I'm fucked.
That's why when you hosted the Adam Carolla show, I was like, this guy knows his music. Like, you were already rattling off names and stuff. And I was just like, maybe this guy would be good for the show. And it turns out, yeah, you've seen everybody and their brother play. That's awesome. Like, something I want to do.
That's funny. I appreciate that because I feel like I suppose everybody feels like they don't know enough about the certain subjects. So I certainly do not consider myself to be in the know as far as music or today's music. But I do feel like when it comes to guitarists, I kind of know probably a little bit more than the average person just because I've played since I was 14 years old and read guitar magazines and geeked out to certain people.
That's awesome. So you started playing in high school or something? Or?
Yeah. You know, you're 4'10", you got glasses, and you like to get high. Well, you're certainly not going to get laid. You're probably not going to be making any sports teams, so you might as well learn some Zeppelin.
Can't hurt, right? Yeah. Jimmy is your only idol at that point. But so you came over to California, and UCB was calling your name. I'm sure that's the same thing as Second City, but more of an alternative crowd. Am I correct? Or?
Absolutely. The UCB theater kind of became – there were the alternative – scene. There was two places for the alternative scene in LA. There was a place called Luna Park, they put on the show called Uncabaret, and that was kind of the original one in LA. It then kind of went away a little bit, and the popular one became a show called Comedy Death Ray, which was put on at M Bar, club called M Bar. It was a restaurant actually called M Bar, and Scott Aukerman booked that. And because Scott was one of the writers on Mr. Show, he could fill the room because he could get David Cross, Bob Odenkirk, all the people that people wanted to, Paul F. Tompkins, that people wanted to see. Then when the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater opened, they had originally opened in New York. They opened a second one here in Los Angeles. I suppose it would have been in about 2004. Then that kind of became where Comedy Death Ray started happening on Tuesday nights. And as a result, the alternative scene kind of went there and merged with the improv scene. And so now it's just so cool. Like last night, I was just hanging out backstage. I did comedy. It's now called Comedy Bang Bang. I'm not sure why Scott changed the name of it, but I was just performing with Maria Bamford, performing as my wife, Jazz. And cool. And just all these great comedians hanging out backstage, Nick Kroll and what's his name that just did the roast. Why am I blanking? Dude, I should tell you, I literally woke up 10 minutes ago, so my mind is not really functioning.
No big deal. Yeah, it seems like a nurturing scene. Aukerman even said he'd be down to do my show, too. And all the guys seem like really nice and not a lot of hecklers coming out of UCB because it seems like everybody's friends already. Am I correct?
Yeah. There's definitely a everybody kind of knows each other. Just the green room back there is such a fun hang. You know, the biggest problem in the green room is because it's you open the door and you're practically on the UCB stage. The biggest problem is people keeping it down in the green room because it's like a little party. So you're on stage and, you know, the theater itself is so quiet.
Farting.
Yeah, and sometimes you can hear, you know, a roar of laughter from the green room or people just hanging out. But
zip
yeah,
it's, it for 1 second. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, it's always nice to have a place where you kind of feel like you belong, and maybe it's where the, I guess, for lack of a better word, the scene is happening.
Awesome. Is it cool? Can I hang up and just make sure I got the file going and give you a call right back in 30 seconds?
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Sounds good, okay. Paul. Okay. Sounds great. Just
cool.
Make sure we're not doing this for shits and giggles here.
Oh, always a good idea. Yeah, I recorded a guy named Martin Willis last week. Martin helped me launch the website for the podcast and a bunch of other stuff, and has kind of a crazy childhood. And so I recorded him via Skype last week. And didn't realize until I played the file back that I was talking too close to the mic and my P's were popping the entire time because I didn't have a windscreen on there. And now I'm like,
so now
I have to redo the interview. But
yeah, about a month ago I did the same thing, but my computer had fried the files, and so we basically had to go back. And the guest wanted to know if I should feign it like we're talking for the first time. And
right.
That makes always for horrible radio. So
yeah.
I said, no, let's just refer to it as the lost episode and just try to come at it at a different angle. But yeah, obviously don't want to have to do that again. So,
yeah, you know, I've had to redo interviews before. Jen Kirkman, I'd screwed up our interview the first time. So I had to re-interview her, and I did repeat questions, but we did also reference the fact that you know, I'd screwed up this previous interview, and we just kind of made fun of it. It's one of the things I learned in stand-up, which is so valuable, is you almost can never go wrong as an artist if you just try to do the most honest thing possible. It's usually either poignant or funny or revelatory or provocative.
Exactly. There's... It's always worse when you try to fake anything. So
Yeah.
So we're talking about UCB, and how about out there? How did you land the gig at TBS's Dinner in a Movie?
It was just an audition. I had signed with an agent when I moved here in 94. And one of the first auditions they got for me was probably wasn't one of the first, but I'd been here about, I moved here in January 94, and the audition was in the summer of 95. So, just went on a cattle call, and they just kept calling me back and whittling it down. And then it was down to me and three other people. They decided on Annabelle. And I thought, I'm not going to get this. I never get this. And she talked the entire time during the interview, steamrolled me. And so I just started throwing jabs at her, saying how white she was. Because she was like, put on some sunglasses and was singing a blues song or something. And I thought this woman's blown it for both of us. I might as well lash out at her. And they liked it. And so I was shocked when they cast the two of us together. And
little did you know, huh? Yeah.
Little did I know that that's what they wanted, was they wanted that, I guess, that spark of, and she and I are friendly today, but we went through a tough patch.
Oh yeah. I'm sure I've heard about.
Yeah. Did not appreciate each other for a number of years.
Did you have any idea it was going to go on as long as it did? Or
No. The first contract was for 16 episodes. I thought, I'll be shocked if this makes it 16 episodes. And it went 16 years.
16 years. That's awesome.
Incredible. Yeah, incredible. Been very lucky. You know, it's afforded me a lot of time to do other things. So I'm grateful.
Of course, yeah. How about when and how did you meet Mr. Adam Carolla? And was it back in the day, like around this time we're talking about?
No, I was performing at the aforementioned Upright Citizens Brigade Theater doing my Republican character. And Mike August, who is the talent booker for Adam, saw me and thought, Adam will like this. And so he booked me. This was when Adam was still doing his radio show. And so he booked me onto Adam's radio show. And I became a regular until Jack Silver, the program director at the radio station, decided that the character was not right for Adam's demographic. Might have been right for Adam, but he didn't feel it was right for Adam's demographic, so I was banned from the show.
And little did they know they would be gone in a couple months too, right?
Yeah, about a year later.
Jack Silver, not exactly a sage, am I correct?
I think he's just kind of that typical radio guy that comes from of that place where it's a failure if everybody doesn't understand it.
Gotcha.
And I come from the school of kind of Christopher Guest, where I seek out comedy that doesn't condescend to me, that requires me to maybe not be an idiot. Although, you know, like Dumb and Dumber is one of my favorite movies. I'm not opposed to slapstick kind of humor that you don't need to be a rocket scientist to get. But I also think there's a place for humor that is subtle and satirical.
Sure.
But radio is not one of those places.
Yeah, I could see that. But yeah, the character makes a lot of people uncomfortable, and I love that about it. I think, like, even music that makes me uncomfortable, so a lot of times I like it. So I think something that keeps people on the edge of their seats or makes them question their own values, I think that's something awesome. And yeah, explain the character a little bit to my audience.
He's a Republican representative from Ohio. It was 2004 when I came up with the idea for the character. It was still during George Bush's first term. And I was on stage one night at M-Bar, and like all the other comedians, I was bitching about the Bush administration. And I got off stage and I thought, we all sound like each other. This is not good comedically. This is boring. What can I do? How can I get this point of view across in a way that's different? And I thought, I know these guys. I went to school with these guys. I went to grade school with these guys. I golf with them. I know what they're like. Why don't I become one of them and go? And this was before Stephen Colbert was doing his thing. So I went to an open mic and performed as this guy, not knowing whether or not it was going to go over. But I knew exactly the way he dressed. So I went, I bought a pinky ring at a pawn shop. You know, I got the pleated khakis, the tasseled loafers, the shirt with the French cuffs.
Puffy shirt, yeah.
Puffy shirt, the perfectly parted hair. You know, those guys, their two things were cemented in seventh grade, their hair and their worldview. And so, I kind of knew who this guy was. I didn't know whether or not people would find the character funny or be able to relate to it. And mind you, as I said, this was before Stephen Colbert was doing his thing. So I went to an open mic around the corner from my house, not knowing whether or not it was going to bomb. And the comedians that were on stage, nobody was listening to him. It was in kind of a loud bar. And I was really close to leaving. And a little voice said, just try it. Just try it. And so I went on stage and you could have heard a pin drop in there. And when the first joke hit, it erupted. It was like there was this catharsis for people. They had been waiting for a way to laugh at what was boiling inside them. And so I kind of felt like I was onto something. And I think the fourth time I performed the character, people from the HBO Comedy Festival were there, and I got invited to do the Aspen Comedy Festival in later that year, and got put on like their big Midnight Friday show. So it was like I knew that I was tapping into something, and I still enjoyed doing the character, but I don't watch as much politics as I used to because it just gets me so angry and depressed.
It sure seems hard. Like it was the right place at the right time, and it was just a perfect idea. I grew up around the suburb of Hinsdale. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, yeah. I went to Hinsdale Central, and
very preppy, very preppy.
So preppy. I was in the wrong place, you know, and a guy who was into punk rock music and just, you know, kind of an outcast. It was not the school for me.
Not a good fit.
Yeah, the teachers would only talk to the cheerleaders and the football team, and it was real tough for me. But yeah, seeing that character, it pretty much encapsulates most of the teachers there, most of the parents there, and it totally, you know, hit a chord with me. So I totally appreciate that character, obviously.
Oh, well, good. Good. I'm glad you like it.
And I'm using this platform of this show and a little bit of, you know, fame or stardom that I would get from it. I'm using it to take it back to Hinsdale and make sure that they get what's coming to them. So
rub it in some faces.
Exactly. And now I'm a whole three towns away in Westmont, Illinois, but it's a completely different feel. It's the home of Muddy Waters. You know, it's a working class town. And I
know Muddy Waters lived there.
Yeah, he lived there in the 70s, actually. And he his wedding party was actually about two blocks away from where I'm doing the show right now. And so Mick Jagger and Eric Clapton all showed up in Westmont, Illinois for one little wedding party. So
that's awesome. Speaking of Muddy Waters, a great little known album, if you're into the blues, is the Fleetwood Mac album. This is pre Lindsey Buckingham, pre Stevie Nicks Fleetwood Mac. This is Peter Green era.
Sure.
Fleetwood Mac, The Pious Bird of Good. And it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was recorded at Chess Studios.
Nice.
With some of those guys. And, you know, you and I were talking before we started recording about underrated guitarists. And I would say Fleetwood Mac era, Peter Green, definitely a really great underrated blues guitarist.
Yeah, Peter Green's awesome. And, like, people don't even know about that early incarnation of Fleetwood Mac. But
yeah, completely different. I mean, they're both great, in my opinion, both incarnations of Fleetwood Mac. Completely different, but yeah, that album, the Pious Bird of Good. I was into vinyl for about a 5-year stretch, and there was this guy who was a total audiophile that I would go buy albums out of his garage. And this guy, I don't know if you've ever met somebody that's like a crazy audiophile, but like every week I would come visit this guy and buy albums, and he would have some new epiphany about what he could do to get the sound more pure out of his speakers. So I get there one week and he's like, I don't even use electricity. I'm running it off battery, the DC current. I mean, he's just spewing all these facts. So.
Oh, I could see it. Sure.
Yeah, that was really funny touring around at that point, being in that kind of subculture of audiophiles, because they're a trip, especially when you meet the guy that has like the big bankroll and Money's No Object, and being at that guy's house just watching. I went to a guy's house to buy, to buy my turntable and needle. And this guy lived in a house, and I remember everything was wood. Literally everything in the house was wood. And
there's acoustics,
I'm not even sure why, but it just such eccentric people.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in a record store, a mom-and-pop record store, like I was taken around, you know, when I was a little boy. Then after high school, got a job at the same record store for 3.5 years. So, yeah, I've ran into many an audiophile, and a lot of them are good guys. A lot of them are just crazy weirdos. Like, if there's a little tiny scratch on the outside of the LP cover, they won't take it or something. But
I've collected a lot of different things in my life, and I've come to and I kind of don't really do it anymore. I've kind of come to realize that for a lot of people, collecting is a nerd way of it's the nerd's baseball bat. I collected guitars for a while, and I was never into lording over my guitar or my guitar collection over other people. But like, I would go to a guitar show and I would bring a guitar to sell. And there were these nerds that would come to your table with the express intent of making you feel stupid. You know, they had no interest in buying your product. They just wanted to let you know they knew more than you and your product wasn't as good as you thought it was. And I just I found that when I was collecting sports cards.
Oh, sure. That's even worse. Yeah.
I found that when I was collecting record albums. And it's kind of, that was kind of the last straw for me when I collected vinyl. I was like, all right, I've had enough of collecting geeks.
I could see you doing a whole episode of your podcast about collectors, because if you're taking it back to psychology, collecting is kind of surrounding yourself with your items until you can't deal with other humans or something like that. Like, I've got such a wall of CDs, and I'm slowly, like, you know, encapsulating myself within my CDs or something. It's like weird that way.
No, I completely agree, Andy. And I think I am going to do a show about it, because it's an expression of OCD. It's a way of trying to control your environment. And I find that when I'm obsessing about acquiring something, I'm usually running from some feeling that I don't want to feel. And so now I'm at the point in my life where I'll sit down and write and try to figure out what is this feeling that I'm trying to run from, instead of going through the internet for 8 hours trying to find a 1985 Paul Reed Smith.
Yeah, I could totally see that. And yeah, I felt that same way. I was an obsessive CD collector for, you know, 10 plus years. And I would go, man, I've got every album of this band except for this one. I sure would like to go to sleep tonight with that last album so I can, you know, have the full collection. And it would be in my, yeah. So it'd be in the back of my head. But now my record store closed its doors last month after 28 years. And so I kind of put that to rest, and I'm putting all my effort into this show and being able to kibitz with people and have that be my big obsession, and have something positive be my obsession. So hopefully that'll be more productive, I think. So
that sounds like a good idea to me. You know, connecting to human beings has been the biggest revelation for me in the last 8 years. You know, I got sober about 8 years ago, and you have to connect to other human beings if you want to stay sober, because one of the things that feeds alcoholism and that need to escape is that feeling of being alone and isolating and letting your fears and your thoughts multiply. But when you connect to another human being, the power is taken out of that obsessive thinking. And I always feel better after I talk to somebody. Well, usually I talk to somebody.
Yeah, that is totally awesome. Something that hits home with me for sure. I've got enough issues. We could be a 3-part episode of your podcast, I'm sure. But yeah, moving on to underrated guitarist. I know Paul's got a lot of info, being firsthand a guitar player, then a collector. So I figured you'd have a lot of info. I picked a couple guitarists. I picked one from the 90s, the 80s, and the 2000s. So how about one of your most underrated guitarists that you run into people not knowing a lot?
Well, I would just have to phrase it as the guitarist that most people have never heard of. And he's probably my favorite guitarist, certainly one of my top five favorite guitarists, is a guy named, I'm sure you know him, Django Reinhardt. And for your listeners, I'll bore them with this story, unless you've told the story already about Tony Iommi.
No, I haven't. So let's just. Okay. Yeah.
Tony Iommi, another great guitarist. A lot of people don't know of the guitarist for Black Sabbath. Had a job working in a sheet metal factory in Manchester, England, and he was getting ready to quit his job because they were had either just recorded their album or were about to record the first Black Sabbath album. And literally his last day at work, he's not paying attention, he's daydreaming, and the sheet metal cutter comes down. It cuts all of the tips of his fretting finger,
ouch,
his fretting hand off. So his first thought is, I'm done. I'm done. I now have no music career. My life is over. I'm stuck at this factory for the rest of my life. And so he goes home and he's miserable, suicidal. He comes in the next day to work, and his foreman says, can you come into my office? The foreman puts on a record and says, I want you to hear this. And so Tony Iommi listens, and it's this really good guitarist. And Tony Iommi says, it's great. What's your point? And the foreman says, that's a guy named Django Reinhardt, and he's playing with two fingers. He was in a fire when he was 18 years old, and the skin on his fingering hand melted together into almost like a claw, and he was only able to move two fingers. And Tony Iommi thought, if that guy can make that much music, because there are times when Django Reinhardt is playing and it sounds like two guitarists playing at the same time. And this is a guy playing with two fucking fingers. And Tony Iommi realized, there's got to be something I can do if this guy can make such beautiful, incredible, passionate music and fluid. So Tony Iommi came up with this idea of putting plastic tips on the ends of his fingers to keep them from bleeding when he played. And to this day, that's what he uses. And you know, Django Reinhardt inspired him to keep going. But even if he'd never done that, Django Reinhardt would be a hero of mine, because his music is just, I don't know how to describe it, but when I hear it, it makes me happy. And yet he's playing almost all his stuff is played in a minor key. And I guess that's one of the things about Gypsy Life is that is the thing that you celebrate the moment. You know, he would win $100,000. He would earn $100,000 playing a gig and literally blow it all that night playing pool and gambling
really?
And buying drinks for everybody. And because I guess that's kind of the gypsy culture that he grew up in is you didn't hold on to things.
You can't take it with you. Yeah.
Yeah. You lived in the moment. And then that joy, that expression kind of is in his music, that celebration, even though it's in a minor key. And that to me, that complexity is what makes it so great. But his phrasing of, you know, some guys can make their guitar talk. He made his guitar talk, and he wasn't even playing an electric. He was playing an acoustic guitar. And that's amazing to me.
That is huge. And that story with Iommi is awesome as well. And then he would go on to give birth to a whole genre himself with heavy metal pretty much. So
yeah. Yeah. Tony Iommi, the godfather of heavy metal guitar. And he heavy metal. I'm sure you know this as well. But because it was so painful for him to push the strings with his damaged fingers to relieve the tension of the strings, he tuned it down a step to make the strings not so taut.
Sure.
Which lowered the sound, which made it deeper and darker. And that was the heavy metal
made it sludgier. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. That is so cool. Well, my underrated guitarist of the 70s, I would go, this guy has got an interesting story too. It's the guitarist and mastermind for the band Boston, which doesn't really get a lot of respect, even through metalheads or classic rock circles, because they just play More Than a Feeling, you know, Peace of Mind. But the guy isn't pretty much an insane guitarist. But what people don't know about him is that he was a really bright guy too. He went to MIT and did a lot of work for the Polaroid Corporation at the same time he was doing this band. So not really your average rock story. He's a vegetarian, completely clean lifestyle guy.
Tom Schatz, right?
Yeah, Tom Schatz. And the guy was insane with these leads. I just put on like their two albums. They only really had two albums in their heyday, but it gave birth to, I think, 8 or 9 singles between the two albums. And they're obviously still classic rock staples now. But if you really listen to the guitar work that's going on, little did we know that he's also playing the bass and the keyboards and a bunch of other stuff. He was kind of like how Billy Corgan was really playing most of the instruments on the Smashing Pumpkins music. He was doing most of the Boston music. So, and at the same time, he's just a businessman and a really smart guy at the same time. So, yeah, I just had to take my hat off for Tom over there from Boston. And it's sad about how the singer killed himself a couple years ago.
Yeah, it really is.
And it was also a really weird way that he did kill himself. He brought in 2 hibachi grills into his bathroom.
Did he really?
Yeah, did you hear that? He just turned on these hibachi grills. He was not cooking anything. And this is, that is a weird way to go. And but I don't think that taints the greatness of the first 2 Boston albums. So
yeah, yeah. Tom Schatz was an electrical engineering genius. He made a little, this is around the era of the Walkman, and he made this thing that I had with me at college, where you could wear it on your belt and you plug your guitar into it.
A little pig nose or?
No, it was called the Rockman. It was called the Rockman. And I think that's what I'm almost positive that's what it was called. But it was that sound that he got out of his guitar. Love it or hate it. It's become a little bit overdone now. But it was an amazing invention to be able to walk around with your guitar plugged into something on your belt, and you'd listen through headphones, and it sounded like you were playing through 5 Marshall stacks. That would not be amazing nowadays, but in 1984, 85. It was amazing.
Was a huge landmark thing, yeah.
Huge, huge, yeah.
Very cool. So that's Tom Schatz of Boston. How about another underrated guitarist for you, Paul?
I love Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Cool.
I just find every lead that he plays is just I tend to like guys that are a little – that tend to underplay sometimes – that could play more notes but choose not to and just kind of play the ones they play have more impact. And he's a guy that I always feel that way about. He never overplays. He always plays what feels like the perfect note. And there's just a feel to his stuff that is just great.
Yeah, it's unmistakable. You could take Petty's his voice out of the mix and still hear Mike Campbell easy. So
yeah.
And those Heartbreakers, yeah, they really kept it together for so long. And I love the keyboardist Ben Montench. He really definitely added his own flavor to the proceedings as well. So
yeah, I actually got to meet him doing. I was doing Richard Martin at Largo a couple of months ago, and he was. Occasionally, Richard Martin will go perform music with these two women, and so we happened to be on a music show that Bentmont was on with some bluegrass players, and I was like, where do I know that face from? I know that face. And he was a super super nice guy.
If you ever see the video for Tom Petty's "I Won't Back Down," it's classic. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite Mike Campbell slide guitar leads. It's just so there's so much air in there, but there's so much feel. It's like it's just nice to hear somebody play a note that lasts a couple of bars and just is just holding it and he's just milking it and feeling it. It's
and he's not using an Ebo, you know.
He's not. I just love what he does.
It was a cool video just because it was so cheap, but it was kind of psychedelic for whatever, 1989, not a real psychedelic time. But they also had Ringo sitting in on the drums for the video, and it just added that last little coolness effect.
Have you seen that documentary on Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers? It's like a 5-hour documentary. It's great.
No, I haven't.
I'm not sure what the name of it is, but I'm sure there's only one 5-hour documentary about Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, but it's great. I love music doc. I love documentaries to begin with, but a music documentary, love it. I'll watch it about bands that I've never even heard of.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the books. Like I've been buying a lot of like rock bio books, and I recently made it out to Portland and went to Powell's Bookstore. Mm-hmm. Which is like 6 floors of goodness, and
I think that's the original Powell's, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the original Powell's, and so I left with about 7 rock biographies in my hand. I said, I can write it off; it's for the show, you know. So
yep, that's right.
And that's speaking of Portland too, my cousin Erin, she worked in Portland. It was a business that was buying up independent record stores. This is about 10 to 15 years ago, you know, when there was still a market for CDs and whatnot. But yeah, it was called Django's Music, and
really?
It was based off of Django Reinhardt, and they made a whole bunch of, you know, advertisement campaign using his face and stuff. They got the family's permission and stuff like that. So I've got stickers of Django's.com and stuff like that. Obviously, it didn't work out for him in the end, but so that was another reason why I had heard of the name Django before. So
yeah, and for your listeners, if you're going to go search, his first name is spelled D-J-A-N-G-O, there are a couple of great songs to listen to. Limehouse Blues is a great one to start with.
Awesome. All right, yeah, I got another one. This one's from the 80s. Bob Stinson of The Replacements.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of people my generation and my age don't really know about The Replacements too much. Same thing
or
with the Mats.
Weren't they called the Mats?
Yeah, the Mats, because people would walk all over them. But,
is that why they were called that?
Yeah, that's what I heard. So, yeah. But, them and Husker Du, I really got into the Twin Cities scene. I interviewed Peter Jespersen, who was basically their manager, their producer for The Replacements, and who now works for New West Records. And
By the way, I just have to say, it's just amazing to me that you love The Replacements and Boston. Because I'm not a fan of Boston, but I'm not going to piss on anybody else's opinion of something. But I love the fact that you can – that you're unapologetic about the fact that you love Boston. I think that's great, because I think a lot of people are afraid to admit that they like something that is maybe uncool in other people's eyes.
Exactly. My friends think I'm quite the weirdo. I like Tupac. I like hip hop music. I like a little bit of dance music, but most of the stuff I like because other people respected it so much that I have to check it out. You know, like being a true sports fan, you have to know every team in the NFL. You know, you have to know the history of the teams. So that's why I equate that with music. I won't know anything about what's happening in 2011 if I don't know about Boston, if I don't know about the Replacements, you know, stuff like that. It can't hurt knowing about the older bands and movements. So So Stinson was a great guitarist, one of those guys who probably didn't know a lot of chords, probably wasn't a reader of music, you know, but put his soul out there with every performance, whether it was drunken or not, but just put his heart and soul on every stage he took up. And you could really hear it in the albums like Hootenanny, Let It Be, Tim. Some great records were made, and it's too bad he had to die of alcoholism in 95. And just a great guitarist, great band. I'm trying to get Paul Westerberg on the show, so that would be awesome. But yeah, any thoughts of Bob Stinson?
No, I don't. I honestly, you know, I know of the Replacements, and I've heard some of their music. I had a roommate in college who was a huge Replacements fan. And he'd always rave about them. But sadly, one of those bands that I just never took the time to listen to more of than the couple of songs that were in rotation on MTV and, you know, maybe an album that my friend had laying around.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, they were really kind of anti the corporate rock scene, and that was before the grunge movement and everything like that. That was, you know, just when MTV kind of kicked in. But yeah, it's just grimy bar music, and it's American music. I like that about it, and unapologetic. So do check it out, Replacements. Any more guitarists you want to talk about, Paul?
John Frusciante. He is a genius. He is a fucking genius. I also like the fact that he created a sound that he, for those people that don't know, he's the guitarist for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, on and off. Did he leave them again?
He left again, unfortunately. They just dropped a new album, I'm With You, and the songwriting is strong as ever, and, you know, drums are great, but something's missing, you know, and it's just because they had to get this, you know. He looks about 20 years old. It says in Wikipedia that he's 32, but I think he's, you know, I think he's a real young guy, and it just... He doesn't have that Frusciante soul, you know, so.
John Frusciante, there's just something about there's a sadness and a vulnerability in his guitar playing that I don't hear anybody else play. And there's also, I mean, he can also rip it up and, you know, play joyously, but there's a breadth of emotion in his playing. And a variety of sound that he gets out of his guitar, and his choice of chords is amazing. You know, that chord, I think it's like a G major seventh or something on Under the Bridge. You know, that song?
Sure.
There's that chord where it's like, wow, that's kind of a freaky chord. And yet it totally works. I mean, who has the balls to play a chord like that on a rock album? I just love that. And he makes it work.
I was just thinking about how that intro to Under the Bridge will be studied for hundreds of years and will be on the level of like even a Mozart or a Beethoven, just because it does not sound like any piece of music that's come before it. So
it doesn't. It doesn't. And, you know, another great intro to a song that is the song Snow. I mean, I've tried to play that song. Playing that once is difficult, but to play that through the entire song while you're singing a harmony, holy shit.
I feel like my hands would be swollen after first verse.
But he's an amazing guitarist, and another guitarist that I thought never got his due as a lead guitarist is Elliot Easton of the Cars. I just think he is one of the best solo guitar soloists ever. Just so melodic and so memorable, just a great guitarist.
And they are they back together and touring?
Yeah, they are. The little bit I've heard of that album, it didn't make me want to run out and buy it, but maybe I'm not hearing the right tracks.
Ocasek is such a, you know, an American songwriting legend too. So, I mean, he's got, you know, 15 to 20 classics in his canon. So I think I'd always go see him no matter what the new album sounds like.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the best albums ever to come out of the 90s is the first Weezer album, which he produced and I'm sure had a huge hand in making them sound different, but poppy and accessible.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of my top five of the 90s too, and he put his stamp on that and, you know, put him in the right direction. And he would come back to later produce their Green album, if you ever heard that one too. And that was just the same thing. It was more pop punk and more tight little short songs, but it sure had that Cars stamp on it. And very successful. So all right, yeah, I got one more before we wrap it up here. Nels Klein, who is the new guitarist for Wilco. He's been with them since 2007. But a Chicago band, Wilco, very important in 2011 because they have that rustic Americana vibe while not trying to play to Nashville or pop radio too much. So,
I was not a huge fan of them when I first heard them. I was actually more a fan of who was the other band that they
Sunvolt
used?
Or Sunvolt?
Yeah, Sunvolt. Yeah, I was more of a fan of Sunvolt. And because they both used to be in Uncle Tupelo.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember what I was. It might have been I was watching a documentary about Wilco, and something about seeing Jeff Tweedy sing made me like their music so much more. And I bought their last two albums and loved them.
Yeah, Tweedy's dark soul comes across whenever you see him live. You can tell he's got some issues you could discuss. And, the whole band themselves were just like a rough, like rowdy kind of version of America that I liked, almost a caricature. And, but now when they got this new guitarist in 07, I believe he's of German descent, and he's of prog rock descent as well. And the first album he was on was Sky Blue Sky, and there's a song on there called Impossible Germany.
That was the first album I started getting into them.
Really?
It's Sky Blue Sky. Yeah,
you go about 4 minutes into the song and it's just kind of like a laconic, kind of like a dirge.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it's like the clouds open up and Nels Klein goes on this weird, you can tell it's like classically trained yet just broken guitar line that repeats for another 2 minutes. And it's just something that would never be on an alternative rock record or never work on a punk album. But it's just something so different and unique and original that I went, okay, this guy is the missing piece that Wilco needed all these years. And has really put them above and put them on a different echelon. Their new album is called The Whole Love. And it is amazing as well. One of my favorites of the year. So do check it out.
I got to get it. And I have to say, you know, what is punk rock should always be changing, because punk rock to me is always about making a choice that's daring and honest and stripped down. And
exactly. Yeah.
And so, in many ways, what people think of as punk is no longer punk and is in fact cliche. Like when I saw Rancid, I thought these guys are the furthest thing from punk, at least that night that I saw them.
Yeah, like I got a friend who's into the Chicago punk scene and who would never listen to a Wilco, never be caught dead listening to any of the music we just mentioned. And it's all passe or cliche to him. But then I go to one of these, loft shows, these punk rock shows. They're all sounding the same with three chords, you know, the same shouted, growled Cookie Monster lead singer guy. And it's become what was punk is now the mainstreamer. It's just, you got to have something that's constantly moving. That's why I like the Replacements, because they were punk, but they also had a country twang to them. They would also try out a ballad. They'd do a weird electronic experiment. It's all about just experimenting. I think that's the most punk you can be.
Yeah, and taking chances.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I had a blast this hour, Paul. Couldn't remember a time I had more fun talking about music on the show.
Well, thanks, Andy. I appreciate you having me on. It's always nice to talk music with somebody who knows what they're talking about. And it's always nice to hear people fill me in on bands and guitarists I've never heard of. So got some stuff to buy and listen to.
Awesome. That's the one reason I do the show, to try to just turn people on to some different stuff, you know. And it's always good talking to a Chicago guy, too. I had a blast. And if you want to find out more about Paul Gilmartin, you can check out his awesome podcast. It deals with psychology and the mental state and the human condition. It's called Mental Illness Happy Hour, and that's at mentalpod.com. How about those Twitters, too?
Yeah, the Twitter feed for the show, for the Mental Illness Happy Hour, is mentalpod. The Twitter name for me personally is Gil Martini, and the Twitter feed for my Republican character is Ohio Congressman.
Awesome. And, yeah, very, very cool character. I love, the range that you've got through all the work that you've done. It's very interesting. So, yeah, we'll definitely have to keep in touch. And, on behalf of Paul Gilmartin, this is Andy Dare saying thank you so much for checking out the Andy Dare Show. You can follow Andy on Twitter at Andy Dare, that's A-N-D-Y-D-E-R-E-R. You can like us at Facebook. The address is facebook.com/TheAndyDareShow. Check us out on YouTube, that's youtube.com/AndrewMartinDare. And it all leads back to TheAndyDareShow.com.